Alright. So we're on week 10. This is sections 37 through 41. So most of what we'll be dealing with tonight is Jesus healing on the Sabbath and the confrontations that he goes through in doing so. So we'll start out tonight. This going. Alright, we'll start out tonight by looking at John chapter 5, and it's the whole chapter basically, 1 through 47, but we're going to be looking first at verses 1 through 18. Somebody want to read 1 through 18 for us tonight?
Okay. After these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porticos. In these lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered, waiting for the moving of the waters. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever then first, after the stirring up of the water, stepped in was made well from whatever disease with which he was afflicted. And a certain man was there who had been 38 years in his sickness. When Jesus saw him laying there and knew that he had already been a long time in that condition, he said to him, "Do you wish to get well?" The man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming, another step down before me." Jesus said to him, "Arise, take up your pallet and walk." And immediately the man became well and took up his pallet and began to walk. Now it was the Sabbath on that day. Therefore the Jews were saying to him who was cured, "Is it the Sabbath, and is it not permissible for you to carry that pallet?" But he answered them, "He who made me well was the one who said to me, 'Take up your pallet and walk.'" Then they asked, "Who is the man who said that to you, 'Take up your pallet and walk'?" But he who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had slipped away while there was a crowd in that place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "Behold, you have become well. Do not sin anymore, so that nothing worse may befall you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. And for this reason, the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But he answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I myself am working." For this cause, therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he not only was breaking the Sabbath, but also was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God.
Okay. So, did Jesus order the man to break the Sabbath? Verse 18 kind of leads us to believe that, right? For this reason, therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he not only was breaking the Sabbath, but he was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. So, did Jesus order the man to break the Sabbath? Okay. Defend your statement.
Well, the Jews made up all these extra traditions.
Okay.
And the Sabbath was a day of rest. But any person would, if they had an animal in distress, would go out and would dig the animal out or save the animal or whatever. So
There were definitely rules about the Sabbath, is that correct?
Yeah,
there were definitely rules. God had put forth rules, but God had also given exceptions for things that could be done on the Sabbath, did he not? Okay? And Jesus, the Lord of the Sabbath, healed this man. So, what our commentator says is, the choices this man had after he was healed, according to Jewish tradition, was either sit there and watch his bed until the Sabbath was over, and then pick it up and go home, or leave it and go home and let it get stolen. Those are the only two choices that the Jews would give him, because of their traditions, not because of Sabbath law. And Jesus makes it abundantly clear. He told him to pick up your pallet and walk, right? Did Jesus violate the Sabbath by doing so?
No. I think so.
Do you think he violated the Sabbath?
I think he did, but we find he violates the Sabbath on a number of occasions.
Well, yeah, but if he's violating the Sabbath, is he breaking law? Is he breaking the law of Moses?
Well, he's there to change it, isn't he?
Right, but is he under the law? Did Christ ever violate the law?
No.
Okay. If he violated the law, he'd be a lawbreaker, right?
Yeah.
And he would have sinned. Right. So I can't see here that he is telling this man to violate the Sabbath. I do not think that the Lord is telling this man that it's a Sabbath, it's okay, you can break the Sabbath. Or that he's saying, I'm God, you can break the Sabbath because I said so.
Yes, but he wouldn't cause somebody else to sin either.
Exactly. So I do not think this was a Sabbath break. I think this was a Jewish tradition break. Okay. I think that the tradition here, all the traditions that these Jews have heaped upon themselves and upon others, what the tithing of mint and cumin and all these things that Jesus spells out later on as we get further into this, all the things they were doing, but they were not keeping the weightier matters of the law, right? That's what he accuses them of. Doing the little things to the nth degree, but not keeping the most important things. Love your neighbor as yourself. Second only to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. They weren't doing that, but they were keeping all these little tiny ancillary traditions. And Jesus points it out to him time and time again. I personally don't think that this was a violation of the Sabbath. And I don't think that he was ordering this man to violate the Sabbath. That would be lawbreaking, and Jesus wasn't a lawbreaker. Jesus was still under the law of Moses. He lived his entire life under the law of Moses until he rose again and the law of Moses was gone, no longer in effect. That covenant had been fulfilled. It had been replaced by the covenant that the Holy Spirit and Jesus would bring upon men. Okay? So he ordered the man to take up his bed and go home. Jewish tradition would say the man must either spend the rest of his day watching his bed or else leave it to be stolen and go home. But Jesus knew that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Jesus was divine in nature and never violated the Sabbath law, but regularly violated Jewish tradition to show that it was not the law of God gave man. Okay? So, Jesus does this on purpose. What would be the purpose of doing this?
To show he had authority over the Sabbath?
Okay, perfect. Another reason. Because, did he do this in a closet?
Yeah.
No.
Wasn't all of his miracles to prove he was God?
Sure. He was proving that he was the Son of God. What's the other reason?
Well, if they can believe Moses' laws, then they should be able to believe him.
Okay. He was doing this to attract the attention of the authorities. Okay? Those authorities who were holding people hostage with tradition. He did it on purpose, Carol.
They talked to him before and said that healing on the Sabbath was forbidden. And so...
So they say.
Okay. And he and his father are one, and he could not do anything without the father. So they are saying that this miracle that happened because of God is sinful. It doesn't wash.
No, it does not. And what we see here is, again, the Sabbath was made for man. God established the Sabbath for a reason. Because we needed it. Okay? Because his people needed it. They needed a day of rest. Because if they didn't have that, they would have our society today. where I have to work on Sundays. Because that freaking sucks. I hate it. I hate working on Sundays. I wish the Sabbath was still in effect, but it's not. At Bymark, the Sabbath was still in effect on Sundays. But it is what it is. In today's age, we see that God understood that we need a day of rest, that we need to have a time where we can reflect, that we can have a time where we can look at what we've done in the past week, where we can take some time and just reflect on those things. That was important. And there were preparations that were made for those things as well. But we're also going to see as we go into this that there were other times where the Sabbath was violated, but without sin. Okay, so we're going to look at those. First, yeah, go ahead, Bill.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When Jesus said that God was his father, did he use a different word for father than the Jews would use if they said God was their father? To distinguish what he was saying.
Right, or we can look at the word that was used. And so we're looking at verse 17 here, where he says, "My father," which is the word pater, which just means father. Okay, so I don't think that's a different word than anything else. It's used 348 times in the New Testament. So
I just didn't think he qualified to be God's child.
Yeah. So I don't think he used a different word for father than he would anywhere else. It was the term of authority, term of endearment that he used to describe God the Father. So, for the last part of this chapter, verses 19 through 47, Jesus goes into a speech about his authority. So, what was Jesus' claim about himself?
Whatever the Father does, he does.
Yeah. So.
He's making himself equal with God.
Yeah, the authority of Jesus. So Jesus' claim about himself was that he was doing the will of his Father. Because he is the Son of God. He's not saying anything unlawful, and he's not saying anything that's a lie. He's telling them the truth. To not tell them the truth would be to hide his true nature, that he is the Son of God, that he was born the Son of God. He was his wife, his mother conceived by the Holy Spirit, and after 30 years of growing up, and you know, the first 30 years of my life were not sinless, but he lived a sinless 30 years. I don't know how he made it through 16 sinless, but but he did. He did. And he's saying, he's doing the will of his Father. All of these things, this is that section in John where there's all these verily, verilies. The point being that he's basically saying, this is how it is. I'm telling you the truth. He says, truly, truly, in verse 24, I say to you, the one who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and does not come to judgment, but is passed out of death into life. Again, in 25, truly, truly, or verily, verily, I say unto you, time is coming and even now has arrived when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. He goes on to say all of these things that these people have never seen before and have no clue what he's talking about. Dropping down in verse 28, do not be amazed at this, for a time is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and will come out of those who did the good deeds to the resurrection of life, and those who committed the bad deeds to the resurrection of judgment. And we know that when Jesus was resurrected, many dead were resurrected, but I don't think that's what he's talking about here. What he's talking about, I think, in verses 20 and 29 is something to come. Something that was in the future of those people, and I think it's something that's in our future as well. Because we haven't seen a resurrection of the dead to righteousness, or those who committed the bad deeds, a resurrection of judgment. We haven't seen that. But it is to come. And who besides Jesus testifies about Jesus' deity? Because Jesus has made the statement, I'm the Son of God. You know, he refers to himself as the Son of Man, the Son of God. He is, and the Jews very rightly understand that he is making a claim that he is deity. He is the Son of God. But he is not the only one who testifies about his deity. Who else does?
Moses.
John.
I kind of just put it all together. I said the Holy Spirit in all of the prophecies and their fulfillments about him. Right?
Well, John also
says John was born to witness the truth.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But again, he was prophesying about Jesus, as were all of the other prophets in the Old Testament who testified of what Jesus would do, what he would accomplish when he was here, what his ministry would be like, even Daniel talking about Jesus and what his ministry would be like. There are so many references to the Messiah and what he would do, what his life would be like, what his death would be like. All of these things that refer to the Messiah, Jesus is claiming that. We read just a couple weeks ago with the lady, the woman at the well in Samaria. She says, when she recognizes what he's talking about, that he's talking about the Messiah, what is he saying?
I am he.
I am he who you're talking about, right? He's making that claim. He's making the claim that that Messiah that's been spoken of through the centuries by so many different people, in so many different places. You're looking at him now.
And 36 says, but I have a greater witness than John's, for the works which the Father has given me to finish, the very works that I do bear witness of me that the Father has sent me.
Absolutely. And he's using the Spirit, working through him, is a testimony of who he is.
And he also says in verse 39, you search the scriptures, because you think in them you have eternal life, and it is these that bear witness of me. So
correct.
The other witness is the scripture.
Exactly. So we see all these myriad of witnesses that testify of Jesus. Jesus is not his only witness. He's got dozens and dozens and dozens of witnesses of who he is, and that he is the Son of God. And he has the power to prove it. And he demonstrates that to these people in a loving and compassionate way. And so we're going to see that amplified as we go into this next set of readings. Let's look at, we're just going to read one of the parallel passages here. Let's read Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. Somebody want to read that? Matthew 12, 1 through 8.
At about that time, Jesus was walking through some grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, so they began breaking off some heads of grain and eating them. But some Pharisees saw them do it and protested. Look, your disciples are breaking the law by harvesting grain on the Sabbath. Jesus said to them, haven't you read in the scriptures what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He went into the house of God, and he and his companions broke the law by eating the sacred loaves of bread that only the priests are allowed to eat. And haven't you read in the law of Moses that the priests on duty in the temple may work on the Sabbath? I tell you, there is one here who is even greater than the temple. But you would not have condemned my innocent disciples if you knew the meaning of the scripture. I want you to show mercy, not offer sacrifices. For the Son of Man is Lord, even over the Sabbath.
All right. So, what example did Jesus hold up as apparent law-breaking?
The priest eating on the Sabbath.
Yeah. The David eating on the Sabbath. It was David eating the showbread on the Sabbath.
But it's also the priest eating.
Well, but it's not the priest eating. It's that they actually bake the showbread on the Sabbath. They're doing work on the Sabbath. That's what they do. That's when the showbread is prepared, because that's when it was commanded to be prepared. But it's work. It's a violation of the Sabbath, right? But it was a commandment, right? So what we see here is we got these Pharisees that are so intensely tied to their traditions that they are unwilling to see the end of the nose on their face. They are absolutely looking for a way to condemn Jesus for what he's doing. And what is Jesus' question to the Pharisees about what he's doing?
Verse 7, but if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, which is in Hosea, you would not condemn the innocent.
Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? That's his question. Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath?
Yes.
Would you, and we just saw a demonstration earlier, would you save your animal that had fallen in a ditch?
You bet.
How much more is a human worth than a sheep? Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? And then Jesus had the power to heal this man. I think I jumped ahead. Hold on a second here. Deleted a slide, didn't I? Let me take a look here in a second. Yeah. There we are. I wondered what was going on. I had deleted a slide on my presentation, but it's still here. So, and we got David and his companions eating the showbread from the tabernacle at Nob, that's near Jerusalem, and then the priest baking the showbread on the Sabbath. Both examples of Sabbath violation, right? According to those Pharisees. But what did they say about David? Those Pharisees also look back at David and say, you know, we are descended through David, through Moses. You know, they try to claim these people as bloodline because of what God said about David, a man after his own heart. A man after his own heart does not violate the Sabbath willy-nilly. He went in and ate the showbread because of necessity. He and his men were starving. Is it okay to do good on the Sabbath? That's what Jesus is teaching. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Okay? And God has always desired compassion rather than sacrifice. Jesus made that abundantly clear by quoting Hosea, where that was said. I desire compassion rather than sacrifice, or mercy rather than sacrifice. What else does Mark tell us about Jesus? We didn't read Mark's, but if we were to look at that scripture in Mark, what else does Mark tell us about Jesus?
Straight away there was in the synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, saying, what have we to do with thee, Jesus of Nazareth? Art thou come to destroy us? I know thee, who thou art, the Holy One of God. And Jesus rebuked him, saying, hold thy peace, and come out of him. And the unclean spirit, turning him and crying with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, insomuch that they questioned among themselves, saying, what is this new teaching? With authority he commanded even the unclean spirits.
All right. You read Mark 3, 1 through 6, right?
One more verse. They came out of him, and a report of him went out straightway throughout all the region of Galilee round about.
Okay. I'm going to back up just a minute to the previous Mark it was chapter 2, verses 23 through 28, which was the parallel passage here. And in that passage, Mark ends the parallel passage with a little bit different idea than Matthew and Luke. What does Mark say at the end of his reading in verse 28?
Consequently, the Son of Man is Lord even on even of the Sabbath.
Right.
But he also quotes, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath.
Correct. And then he says, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Okay? So, point being, Jesus' superior understanding of the law that he wrote, right, helps him to help others understand what the Sabbath was made for. Okay? Jesus was intimate in the creation of the law of Moses. He was there for it. Okay? He knows exactly what the law was written for and what the law says. And the purpose that it had. Go ahead, Carol.
In verse 26, it adds that Abiathar the high priest, and they ate consecrated bread, which is not lawful for anyone to eat except for the priest. And he gave it also to those who were with him.
Right.
And it almost seems as if the high priest is condoning this.
Right.
So
well,
if the priest high priest would condone it, then
right.
why are you complaining?
Right, and that's Jesus' point. The high priest gave them the showbread. Okay? Yes. It was a violation of Sabbath law. But again, Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. These men were in need. They were starving. And the showbread there sits throughout the Sabbath. It's baked on the Sabbath. Sits there on a table as a display of bread. And then at the end of the Sabbath, it can be eaten by the priests. These men came in hungry. Of necessity, they needed food. The only food that was available was the showbread. The priest gave it to them, understanding the meaning of the Sabbath law.
And compassion.
Compassion.
And I feel like whenever it's in red, that's Jesus speaking, correct?
Right.
Like, okay. I just feel like he just, in one of those moments, was just like, whoa. And then it just like shut everybody up. Like that last statement, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath.
Right.
And yeah. And just like, no, and they just couldn't say anymore.
Right, and they gloss over the fact in Matthew that he points out that they're violating the Sabbath by baking the showbread on the Sabbath anyway, right?
Well, according to you. That's what I was wondering, because their ladies were making dinner for them, weren't they? I mean, isn't that the point of the Sabbath, was to just
well,
get together
the,
and
the Sabbath the Sabbath meal is usually prepared the night before.
Oh,
yes.
So that nobody has to do anything.
Correct, no work
okay.
on the Sabbath. But
okay.
but the priests baking the showbread on the Sabbath.
Right.
Okay, so... Jesus' point is, they're violating the Sabbath, but it's okay. Or is it? Well, the point that he's making is, that's the way God structured it. He put it together that way. The Sabbath is not a hard line that you cannot cross. It was put there for a purpose, because of your hardness of hearts, because you don't understand. And God made the Sabbath for you to reflect, to give you a day of rest, because he knows you need it. Okay? And what you've done, and Jesus is pointing this out to the Pharisees, is you've taken this law of compassion, God's being compassionate on you, saying you don't have to work 7 days a week. Work six, take one off. That's compassion. And what we see is these people using it as a hammer.
Well, isn't it
to beat people
time
over the head.
For them to gather together and have fellowship?
Sure,
you know?
Absolutely. There, of course, there were traditions about how far you could walk and those kind of things. But those were traditions.
Right.
They weren't spelled out. There were certain things that you weren't allowed to do on the Sabbath, and God did spell those out. And eating the showbread was one of them. But God did not consider it a sin when David and his companions did that. Because God understands that the Sabbath was a compassion day. A day of compassion on his people. A day of rest. All right. Let's, moving on to our next set of readings, and Bill has already read this one for us. It was about this healing on the Sabbath. So, Jesus walks into the synagogue on the Sabbath. He is teaching, and the Pharisees know that there is this man who has a withered hand. And what are they doing? They are eagerly watching to see what he does. So Matthew chapter 12, verses 9 through 14, it reads, "Departing from there, he went into their synagogue, and a man was there whose hand was withered. And they questioned Jesus, asking, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?' So that they might bring charges against him. But he said to them, 'What man is there among you who has a sheep, and if it falls in a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable then is a person than a sheep? So then it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath.' Then he said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand,' and he stretched it out, and he was restored to its normal like the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him as how they might destroy him." In what Bill read, it says that these Pharisees were watching him closely to see if he would heal this man with a withered hand on the Sabbath, so they might accuse him. And in Luke, again it says, "Now the scribes and the Pharisees were watching him closely to see if he healed on the Sabbath, so that they might find a reason to accuse him." All right?
They remind me of the devil trying to trick us.
So, what is Jesus' question to the Pharisees?
Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good?
Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? Jesus had the power to heal the man. And to not do so when he was in need would be a waste of Jesus' talents and show a lack of compassion for this man in need. Right?
I don't know where it is, but isn't there somewhere that it says that to do good, there's no law against this? I don't know where it is.
Well,
but
it says right here in Luke, it says, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy?" Is that what you're thinking?
No, it says there's no law against doing good.
Oh.
And I don't know where it comes from, but
I could find it for you. I'm not pulling it out of the book chapter verse out of my mind right now, but I do know what you're talking about. And again, just a reinforcement of the point or the idea that these Pharisees and scribes and those trying to accuse Jesus do not understand what the Sabbath is for. They don't understand it.
No, he got kind of mad because in Mark 5 it says, "And after looking around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, he said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored." So, Jesus is getting irritated with the people for not listening to him.
Again, what we see here is Jesus knew their hearts. This wasn't a setup. I don't think that the scribes and Pharisees dragged this withered hand man into the synagogue. I think this man was probably fulfilling his Jewish duty. He was there on the Sabbath, probably had given sacrifice, was there to listen to the scriptures being read. Just because he has a withered hand doesn't mean that he can't live a normal life. But Jesus takes compassion on this man and does good on the Sabbath. And they try to accuse him for it. They try to accuse him for doing good. So Jesus asked them this question. Why didn't the Pharisees answer?
They didn't say a thing.
They condemned themselves.
Well, if they answer in the affirmative, he asked, is it okay to do good on the Sabbath? If they answer in the affirmative, then what have they done?
They've admitted that they
that they're wrong.
Yeah,
they're admitted. They're admitting that they're wrong. And if they say it's not okay to do good on the Sabbath, then what are they admitting?
That they're no good.
That God doesn't allow good on the Sabbath.
Right.
They're not going to condemn doing good on the Sabbath because Jesus already set an example in front of them, which of you would not pull your sheep out of a pit, right? Doing good on the Sabbath. an animal in distress, and you save the animal. What's the difference between an animal and a man? Well, a man is worth much more than an animal. Have we not been told that many, many times? And this man was in distress. Jesus had the power to heal. Jesus demonstrated his power on the Sabbath, doing good. He took every opportunity on the Sabbath to do this, to try and get it through their thick skulls and hard hearts that the Sabbath was made for man. Man was not made for the Sabbath. Carol.
It also says in Luke 6:11, but they themselves were filled with rage and discussed together what they might do to Jesus. When you're full of rage and anger, you aren't looking at anything logically. You aren't searching the scriptures, you know. And they were filled with rage probably the whole time.
Right. And so now we see that they're going to conspire. Who are they conspiring with to kill Jesus over this healing a man on the Sabbath? And why are they conspiring?
Herodians.
The Herodians. Who are the Herodians? So the Herodians are Jews who were secular. Secular Jews. So they weren't considered pure like the Pharisees. They weren't considered to be those who were capable of being leaders of the Jews. But these secular Jews, these Herodians, were also more powerful than the Jews. They were those who were in secular leadership positions, like Herod. Okay? So they're conspiring with these Herodians, who they dislike, who they find distasteful, because these secular Jews, these Herodians, can get lawful authorization to kill Jesus. All right? So they needed their secular power to have Jesus put to death. And we're going to see that there is so much of this throughout Jesus' ministry, of this hypocrisy from the Pharisees. Bob.
I have a footnote on the word rage in chapter verse 11 that Carol referred to.
Yeah.
That it represents folly. And if you think of that as folly instead of rage, it puts a whole different spin on what's going on. Mentally, it's folly for them to think that they could actually do something to the Son of God.
Right. I wholeheartedly agree. I thought you were talking about Jesus becoming angry with them. And the idea that Jesus healed this man out of anger? No.
Yeah.
No. He became angry with them. He healed the man out of compassion. And in doing so, it angered the Jews. They were angry that he did it. For two reasons. One, he violated the Sabbath. And two, he healed a man. Something they can't do. They are upset with him. Because he's demonstrating his power, showing that he is the Son of God. That he has the divine authority. All of these things upset them. But he's doing it on the Sabbath. Breaking their tradition. And so, I wouldn't say that Jesus is throwing it in their face. I would say what Jesus is doing is using these teachable moments to try and help these people understand who they are. Because they've obviously forgotten what it means to be a Jew. What it means to be God's chosen. All right, our next set of verses starts with Matthew chapter 12, verses 13 to 21. Somebody want to read that?
And he said to the man, hold out your hand. So the man held out his hand, and it was restored just like the other one.
No.
No?
Right.
It was restored just like the other one. Then the Pharisees called a meeting to plot how to kill Jesus. But Jesus knew what they were planning, so he left that area, and many people followed him. He healed all the sick among them, but he warned them not to reveal who he was. This fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah concerning him. Look at my servant whom I have chosen. He is my beloved, who pleases me. I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not fight or shout or raise his voice in public. He will not crush the weakest reed. He will not crush the weakest reed or put out a flickering candle. He will cause justice to be victorious, and his name will be the hope of all the world.
All right. And somebody read the parallel verse, Mark 3, verses 7 through 12. Gives us a little more information.
And Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, and from Jerusalem, and from
Tyre,
and from beyond the Jordan, and the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon, and a great multitude of all that he was doing came to him, and he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the multitude, in order that they might not crowd him. For he had healed many, and with the result that those who had afflictions pressed about him in order to touch him. And whenever the unclean spirits beheld him, they would fall down before him and cry out, "You are the Son of God." And he earnestly warned them not to make him known.
All right. So why did Jesus want a boat?
People were crowding.
Yeah, I mean, he couldn't, to the point where all, I mean, we just saw these people are coming from where? They're coming from Galilee, Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, Jordan, Tyre and Sidon's over on the coast. I mean, he's got throngs of people around him. And what are they trying to do?
They just want to touch him.
They want to touch him. Thousands of people want to touch you. Jesus says, "Give me a boat. I want to get out in the water so I can talk to these people and teach them. All I want to do is touch me," because they get healed when they do. So they get him a boat so that he can teach them. Because man does not live by bread alone, right? It's not just food. It's not just healing your disease. It's learning what the gospel is. It's listening to the good news that Jesus has to tell you. And these people, all they had in their mind was what? I want to be healed. I want to touch him. So he asked his disciples to get him a boat so that he could get out in the water and teach these people. All right? When the people understood that just touching Jesus could heal them, they were just crowding around him to the point where he couldn't get anything done. So he wanted to teach them not just to heal their infirmities, and a boat would allow him to be within earshot of the people. We see him do this more than once. We read about this about 4 weeks ago when he got out on the boat. And that's when he called Peter and Andrew, right? James and John, told them to cast their net over the boat. We read that, you know, in Mark's version, he just called them and these men followed. But in the other version that we read, in the other gospel, he went out on the boat, he told them to cast their nets. They had been fishing all night, they got nothing. They took in so much that it almost sunk two boats. And Peter said, "What? I'm not worthy to be around you." And then Jesus said, "Well, follow me." Right? He called them. That's the nice thing about reading the different points of view in the Gospels, is you get a little more information from each different point of view. So who recognized Jesus as the Son of God, and what was Jesus' response to them?
Unclean spirits.
Right. So these demons. And Jesus, if we look at Matthew's account, in verse 15, Jesus was aware of this, withdrew from there, many followed him, and he healed them all, and warned them not to tell them who he was. Warned who? Matthew's account. Is he warning the people who he's healing not to tell them? Right? We get a little more information about what's going on here, though, right? Mark tells us who he warned. He warned these demons, because he's healing these people. Part of what he's doing, though, in healing some of these people is casting out demons, right? Unclean spirits. And these unclean spirits fall down recognizing what?
That he's the Son of God.
That he's the Son of God. These people don't recognize it, but But the demons do. These demons recognize that he's the Son of God. And that they are afraid of him. And Jesus warns them not to tell anybody who he is. Jesus has so much to accomplish in his ministry. And we can already see right now, we're only months into his ministry, maybe a year. Maybe we've just passed the first Passover since he started his ministry. They already want to kill him. He knows his time is short, right? His ministry was very short, 3 years. He had so much to do. And these demons who recognize him as the Son of God fall down and cry out that he is the Son of God. He tells them, keep it quiet. Carol.
We also have the example later on with one of the apostles where the lady was prophesying, was a soothsayer sort of thing, and she was following Jesus, following and saying that Jesus was the Son of God, and they didn't want somebody who was an evil spirit speaking and testifying towards God's divinity, or Jesus' divinity. So.
Right. I mean, Jesus knows that these demons recognize him as the Son of God. I can't say that I understand how long these demons, if they're eternal, you know, or if they, I'm sure they're created beings that fell just like Satan did, and that they are finite, just like Satan will be. But they obviously understand the spirit world better than you and I do, right? I mean, I don't know how to get in your body and control you. So they obviously understand the spirit world, how to manipulate nature better than we do. But Jesus told them not to reveal who he was because his time was not done. He had much to accomplish. And knowing what the end of his ministry was going to be, he needed as much time as he could get. And so we see more than once that as we get into further into the Gospels, that these raging Pharisees and scribes tried to grab him, and he miraculously disappears from them, gets out of their grasp, because it was not time yet. But he had a lot to accomplish. And so when he was casting out demons like this, we're going to see more than once that he warns them, shh, don't tell them who I am. All right. And then our final part of this study this evening was Jesus selecting his 12 apostles. There's a little bit of information here. These are very similar accounts. If somebody wants to read the first four verses of Matthew chapter 10.
And when he had called his 12 disciples to him, he gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease. Now the names of the 12 apostles are these. First Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus, and mine says this Levicus, what's that?
It's the Greek.
Whose surname was Thaddeus? Yeah. I don't think I've ever read that before. I must have skipped that one. Simon the Canaanite and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. Sorry about that.
That's all good. And then Mark chapter 3, verses 13 through 19.
And he goeth up into the mountain and calleth unto him whom he himself would. And they went unto him, and he appointed 12, that they may be with him, that he might send them forth to preach, and have authority to cast out demons. And Simon he surnamed Peter, and James the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, and them he surnamed Boanerges, which is sons of thunder. And Andrew, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him.
All right. And then Luke chapter 6, verses 12 through 16.
And it was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also named as apostles: Simon, whom he also named Peter, Andrew his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor.
Right. So two of these accounts tell us something that Jesus did before he named his 12 apostles. What did Jesus do?
Spent the night in prayer.
He spent the night in prayer. He was making a huge decision, right? He was going to call these his 12 sent, right? The ones that he was going to send out to preach, perform miracles, heal the sick. And he spent the night in prayer. Matthew doesn't tell us about that. It just says that he summoned them and gave them authority over clean spirits to cast them out and heal every disease. But the other two tell us about that.
He also selected the one who would betray him.
Absolutely. He did. We see that each one of them tells us that Judas was selected. Knowing, and Jesus knowing his heart, knew that he was a thief. And we're told later on that Judas regularly stole from the money that was collected to help them on their journeys, on their travels. And that Judas was named as the one who would betray him. And to the point that there are prophecies about Judas, correct? About what would happen to him after he betrayed him.
And then John's the only one that called Bartholomew Nathanael.
A surname?
Yeah.
But we also see that some of these give us different nicknames that he gave them. The Sons of Thunder. That's only mentioned in Mark.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that that's the only place they use.
Yeah. That's why, again, I point out that it's very important when you're reading through the Gospels to look at the parallel passages, because it's inevitable that one point of view gives you some information and another point of view gives you more information, and they may not be the same exact, but they coincide together for a single event and give you the whole picture. That's why it's great to go through the fourfold gospel here and see all of these different accounts and how they add up to one full picture of Jesus' ministry. That winds up our study for tonight. Next week will be week 11. It's the Sermon on the Mount. John inquires of Jesus from jail.
Yeah, I've got that.
Jesus' feet anointed and teaching in Galilee. Any comments or questions this evening before we close out?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, when you said that I lost the chapter about the dead and the raising of the tomb, or the people in the tomb when they hear.
Okay.
So is that first one the dead, meaning like those that don't believe and that suddenly do believe? Or, and then what do they mean by the people in the tomb will also hear? Like, the dead will hear? My thinking of that is that, so I have a gentleman that I speak to, and he is a Latter-day Saint. And when they build this new temple, he told me that they will bring the ashes of the dead, and they will bring them to the temple, and they will be baptized, and then they will all go. So is that kind of where they're getting that, the tomb of the dead? I mean,
I can't tell you where they're getting that, because I'm not spiritual.
It just threw me. I just kind of was like, I don't really.
No, there.
But
Jesus alludes to he has at least a couple of different inferences to the dead rising, or the dead hearing from the tomb, and it is eyewitness accounted that when Jesus came back from the dead, many also came back from the dead with him.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean that what that shows us is God's power to raise people from the dead. Jesus demonstrates that with Lazarus when he raises him from the dead. That's demonstrated by multiple apostles, too, when they raise people from the dead.
That in that section, it was the things that testified for Jesus, and it testifies that he has control over death.
Okay.
And that's why that particular one was there. Why they want to baptize the ashes is because they get somebody who, oh, I know my son was a sinner, and I just can't stand the fact he's not going to go to heaven. And well, if you come here, we can pray over the ashes, and we can baptize the ashes, and we can save somebody. We can save somebody who died 100 years ago, 200 years ago.
Right.
So that gets people who are vulnerable, it gets them to listen and come into the congregation. That's why I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I just know there are some references in the Bible that I think, oh, is that where the Catholics got that? Or, oh, is that where the...
And
is that just reading into it, like changing the way it's read so that it fits there?
If you want to know where they get a lot of that stuff, read the book of Daniel. Because they turn that 9 ways to Sunday. It's unreal, some of the things that they pull out of Daniel. Where people, I mean, that's been, Daniel's been the focus of so many people predicting things that are going to happen at the millennium and in 2012. That, you know, God wrote the code of life into the book of Daniel. No. Daniel's just a prophet, just like all the other prophets, and Daniel testified of the Messiah, of what was going to come. He testified of the fall of the kingdoms, of what would happen there as well. But most of the things that Daniel tells us about, there's some things that are a little harder to grasp, but most of the things that Daniel testifies about are things that are fulfilled in Jesus. Those prophecies are fulfilled, and Jesus tells us that every prophecy that was written about him was fulfilled.